physical nature always resists being organized in unnatural ways. We've talked about how consciousness is supernatural. And just in a brief mystical succinctness, the Holy Ghost is the supernaturalness of God. Let's dwell just a moment on the Christian theology. God may have a son, but it's only with the death of the Son that the Holy Ghost, the supernatural consciousness of God, can come. The Son is a natural occurrence from a Father. The Father and the Son put into the natural course of events. But it's only when the natural course of events is disrupted that a supernatural quantum jump can occur. As long as the natural steps are in place, as long as the natural sequence is moving, nothing supernatural can occur. It's only by the interruption of the natural sequence that something supernatural like consciousness can occur. The Elizabethan saying is that violent deaths leave ghosts. If you die a natural death, there is no ghost. If you are murdered, if you are ripped apart by your neighbor's Dobermans, you will leave a ghost and be able to haunt the natural realm with your supernatural presence and slime them. Understanding consciousness as supernatural means then, in a very colloquial way, that somehow consciousness does not belong in the natural world of time-space. It isn't a part of time-space. It's not an element in the makeup of time-space. Consciousness is different, and therefore consciousness, at least in a token beginning understanding, consciousness is a different dimension. When you compute all the characteristics of four-dimensional continuum of time-space, consciousness is not taken into account. Now, the only way to really know this, other than a very high-powered yogic samadhi, is to travel to late 20th century science. And in particular, the realm where this has become manifest more clearly than in nuclear physics, and even with more clarity than in extragalactic astronomy, is in the area that I lectured on Thursday night here. It's called the Science of Chaos. I'll just give the conclusion to that Thursday lecture, because the tapes are available and our tape reproduction machine is going to be back next week, and you can get tapes, or you can listen to a tape. The final message is that there is disorder. That is, in the natural order of time-space, in the natural sequence the supernatural does occur. It does exist. The physicists and mathematicians want to discover regularities. That's what they want. And you get what you want. It's Jean-Paul Sartre said, man is condemned to freedom. He gets exactly what he exactly wants. It's like the folk tale, don't frown because your face may freeze, in that expression. If you had old European grandmothers, you would have heard that as a little baby. You get exactly what you want. So if you are deceiving yourself, if you're unclear about what you really want, you'll become surprised at what happens in your life, but you actually get exactly what you want. And if you want, as a mathematician or as a physicist, to have order, then that's all you see. But the fact is that in a neutral, disinterested analysis, which you can have either as a Yogacaran or as a late 20th century scientist, you can get to a perspective where there is a neutral, non-charged, non-biased perspective. And in that perspective, disorder is not just an occasional irregularity, it is a constituent of what is actually real all the time. Or as they used to say, all the goddamn time. It is only by ritual selectivity that we can convince ourselves that the order that we have established is the whole show. And this, incidentally, allows for most science to slip back regressively to just a ritual comportment. Not in its pristine satipatthana thusness, which would be creative and generate truthful meaning, but in a regressive mode where one becomes able to project one's attention back to nature with a delusive cloud, a veil, in front of oneself, so that the ritual becomes de-evolutionary. Your perspective devolves and it becomes more and more materialistic. One is more and more electrocuted by things because one holds on to them more and more. They are facts. One of Charles Dickens' novels, one of the characters, Gradgrind, says, I want only facts. The final message is that there is disorder. Physicists and mathematicians want to discover regularities. People say, what use is disorder? But people have to know about disorder if they're going to deal with the wholeness. The auto mechanic who doesn't know about sludge and valves is not a good mechanic. It does exist, it does occur, and in fact occurs all the time. This was a quotation from James York, who gave the science of chaos its name. He was a mathematician, still is. Robert May, a biologist, who was trying to deal with computer models of global population, took a brilliant strategy not long ago, less than a decade ago. He focused more and more closely on the critical boundary between steadiness and oscillation. Now, steadiness and oscillation are a true polarity. Steadiness and oscillation are a more archetypal polarity than black and white. In fact, in the realm of color, black and white are not a very good polarity at all. Gray and the rainbow would be a much better polarity in the realm of color than black and white. But steadiness and oscillation. Now, if you focus on the critical boundary between steadiness and oscillation. The way that the Tao puts it is movement and no movement. The way Euclid put it, a point and a line. The critical boundary between them, differentiating between them, where does that critical boundary exist? It is not characteristic of either pole in the polarity. The critical boundary exists only in an observer who is recognizing the polarities. So that the critical boundary is a self-reflexive point of consciousness. The critical boundary between two polarities is the observer. Now, the more and more that you focus on that in terms of very high-powered computer mathematics, these computer programs would use something like 500,000 equations per second. There's 500,000 perspectives, mathematically sound, per second to get a true gestalt of the trigonometric wholeness of what is occurring. And as Robert May focused more and more clearly on the critical boundary between steadiness and oscillation, he found that there is always a quaternary structure of periodicity. Periodicity means a repeating sequence. So that in nature, there's always a quaternary structure that occurs and comes out. But it has a very special, specific nature. It isn't just that periodicity occurs in fours, it occurs specifically in pairs of twos. That is, when you reduce the archetype down and you see what it is, it's always pairs of pairs. Like Lao Tzu says in the Tao Te Ching, the Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao, but the Tao that can be named is the mother of the 10,000 things. And at the deepest of things is their pairing. And the ultimate deepness is the pairing of pairing. Now, May, being a mathematician in the 20th century, did not use the term pairing. He used the term bifurcation, because he was looking at it from a differential quality, not a quality of wholeness, but differentiation. So that the bifurcation of bifurcation is the quaternary structure which is characteristic from a neutral standpoint of all periodicity. So when someone says, the psyche can be shown to be a quaternary in structure, it's not an artifact of our time, which likes to think in quaternaries. It's true regardless of what time you live in, regardless of what planet you live on, regardless of what star system you're in. All periodicity in formed time-space has a quaternary structure precisely as the bifurcation of bifurcation. And that archetypal pattern has a very peculiar effect. Its proliferation reaches a saturation point where it runs out. It stops proliferating. It runs 4, 8, 16, 32, blank. Now, if you can carry it to the nth degree, it runs 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, blank. This is the way May summed it up, there's a quaternary structure of periodicity beyond which infinitely different values proliferate. Infinitely different values proliferate. We used the term once of George Gamow's wonderful phrase that he uses as the title of one of his books, 1, 2, 3, Infinity, with an ellipse between it. 4, 8, 64, infinity would be a much better way to state it. It's not just that there are 64 hexagrams in the I Ching, and that's all, and that's enough. It's not just that there are 8 trigrams in the I Ching, and that's all, and that's enough. And that's an archetypal symbolic structure built on what can be expressed through bifurcation. And it's not just a coincidence that there are only 64 codons in the DNA sequencing. It means that when you have reached that complexity, that scale of complexity, infinity becomes possible. In other words, there is a quantum jump, and the jump is to infinity. May gave a name to that mathematical point where there's a jump to infinity. He called it the point of accumulation. It was a mathematical term. It's a computer term. The point of accumulation. Beyond a certain point, he said, beyond a certain point, the point of accumulation, periodicity gives way to chaos. Infinite varieties of fluctuations that never settle down to any order at all. But the big conjunction, you've heard of the big sleep and the big fix. Well, this is the big conjunction. But there is a pattern, a universal hermetic pattern, in the movement of chaos, in the movement of infinity. And that universal pattern is the pattern that was found to characterize what now is known in the science of chaos as Lorentz attractors. And I left some sheets on the table. And you can see the old hermetic infinity sign. But this time, instead of coming up on a page, it comes up in a three-dimensional space with a time continuum. In other words, the three-dimensional continuum, having three coordinates, the x, y, and z coordinates, which are characteristic of a trigonometric space rather than a geometric plane, having the time element added, the movement of any element, any extant element, any existentially present atomic or molecular structure in that four-dimensional time-space continuum will always describe in its completeness this form, the symbol, the infinity symbol, the hermetic symbol, the 8. It's a universal law. It's a universal law which the science of chaos brings out. The key here, the trigger for us to remember, to understand, to believe in, is that that point of accumulation, in Robert May's language, is a very accurate description of what the deep self does in reality. The deep self is the point of accumulation, beyond which an infinite diversity is characteristically possible. what it means psychologically is that integration is not an infinite process. You don't keep integrating infinitely, but there is a point of accumulation, like a white light black hole, where the integration is complete. And it implodes in upon itself in such a way that it goes back out. Now, in alchemy, this was known as the star regulus. When you saw this in your test tube, and I'll show you a photograph of a chemical experiment showing us the star regulus from working with antinomy. The deep self is the ultimate integration taken one step further. That is, when you go beyond the point of accumulation, you come back out into an infinite universe where this double Lorentz attractor creates in the four-dimensional continuum, that ancient Hermetic sign. So that once the infinity sign served man well because his mind was able to comprehend geometry and just barely strain to understand trigonometry. The first trigonometry occurred in the 3rd century AD in Alexandria. Until then, no one could have possibly conceived it except in very high mystical states. But to be able to mathematically express it was really something. It was the high water mark of mathematical intelligence in the ancient world, the development of trigonometry and trigonometric functions, to be able to understand that. One is right on the verge, then, of developing calculus, because once you have trigonometry and the trigonometric relations, and an algebraic capacity, you're right on the verge of calculus. And of course, it took 1,300 years to come back to that point and develop it. At least 1,300 years in the West, where there was no dark age in China. Calculus was developed by the 9th century in Taoist monasteries, but was used only as a mind training exercise and not put into practical application, because the imperial feudal order of Chinese society did not like to really make available for everyone. They didn't like technology to be applied. They didn't like science to be applied. They liked it to be the prerogative of the emperor, and only he and his advisors can know. And in order to cement your being emperor, you killed your advisors off every so often to keep them on their toes. So that while it occurred, while the conscious threshold was achieved, it was never brought into being. It was never manifested, as we would say. But 300 years ago in the West, with Newton and Leibniz, it was manifested. And it's like, that's why the 17th century in Western European mentality is very much like the Tang Dynasty. The mentalities are very similar. They're both threshold cultures that are approaching the ability to literally calculate infinite integration and infinite differentiation. But with infinite integration, what happens is that you have the implosion to a transformational beyond. You go beyond nature. You go into the supernatural. You go into consciousness, which when it first occurs is pure consciousness. Has no expressive form whatsoever other than just itself occurring. And so the traditional description is a blankness, a naught. In India, where this was this aspect was concentrated on, the concept of zero came out in the 3rd century AD. That there is such an occurrence in this universe as zero. And that, in fact, the zeroness of the universe takes part in every numerical happening. Only one didn't know that before. Ten, as the first manifest use of zero. One, zero is ten. It's not one plus zero, but that place mode occurs and is valid, is procedurally and structurally sound. Now what happens here in the science of chaos? The point of accumulation, the deep self, is able to be manifested, able to be expressed in such a way that you could teach someone how to recognize this level, this dimension. All this has happened in the 1980s. The 1990s will not resemble the 1980s. The 1980s resembled the 1950s, but the 1990s will be like an asymptotic jump of the 1960s, a quantum jump. This point of accumulation, the bringing of integration together, so that the natural energies reach a culmination, and at that culmination, they literally, like a black hole, only this is a black hole of white light, or clear light, even stronger, pokes through the fabric of nature and comes out the other side, comes out on the hidden side, the invisible side. The traditional Buddhist ascription of this is Parayana. Parayana. One of the books that I wrote and will publish sometime is called Parayana. It's the way beyond. Not the way to there, wherever there might be, or the way to it, whatever it might be, but the way beyond. Para. So that when asked about himself, the Buddha said that I am the Tathagata. I'm the one who's gone beyond. In my state now, I am not here. I am not here in a way in which you would colloquially say that I am here. I am gone. Now, the way that the Buddha taught this was in a sermon that was remembered very accurately because these listeners like you were tuned to hear what was being said and later to think about it. And in the collection called the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length sayings of the Buddha. They wanted to have a neutral way of categorizing the sayings of the Buddha, so they chose length. The short sayings, the middle-length sayings, the long sayings. Just on the time that it takes to deliver, so that no one would mischaracterize what he said. In the middle-length sayings, in the Majjhima Nikaya, of which there are 152, one of the sermons concerns the progression, the sequence, the 4, 8, 16, 32, 64 infinity sequence by which consciousness frees itself by ultimate integration, constellating the star regulus of the accumulated point deep self and goes beyond. Because of time limitations, I'll just give you a colloquial, succinct cartoon of it, but I will make copies for you so you can have it. It's one of the great lessons for mankind. You don't have to be a Buddhist. It's one of the great lessons for mankind, because it's a very truthful, exacting sequencing of the way out of naturalness, using nature itself as the ladder. In other words, we have to understand that the supernatural is a unbelievably accurate way in which nature flowers. Or, to put it in the way in which the Mahayana always put it, the flower is the pinnacle of nature, but the fragrance of the flower is the beginning of the supernatural. So that in the Mahayana, the way that the Bodhisattvas talk, is that their good works perfume nature. And that perfuming of the natural universe helps all sentient beings come to their own flowering. If you try to work with any structure in nature, your activity changes the very structure that you're working with. So that the only way to really help someone is not to interfere with their structure at all, but you can help them in a paradoxical way by giving your perfumingness to their activity. It doesn't interfere with their structure in any way. It doesn't interfere with the prime directive in any way. And yet alerts them to the possibility that they too could flower, they too could perfume. They too could become helpers. And of course, as soon as that thought, it's called the bodhicitta, the thought of enlightenment. As soon as that thought occurs to someone, they're on the path. The Sanskrit term for that, which is jnana, is probably better used in a structural way. The term that would be used in India now is not jnana, but marga, path. What you are following is your marga, but all margas are part of a jnana. In other words, the path seems to us to be a quest sequencing, when actually it's the generation of a vehicle. You don't go anywhere. The quest path doesn't go anywhere. It's like Buckaroo Banzai said, wherever you go, there you are. You don't ever go anywhere. That's the stillness. That's the steadiness. But it always seems like you're going somewhere. In a Heraclitean sense, you never step into the same stream twice. You never breathe the same air again. That's the constant oscillation. The interface between the two is the same kind of interface that occurs in all cellular structures. All life vehicles in nature, the way that the cells come together, the interfaces of the plasma membranes of the cell, always have in their very center a kind of a hydrophobic vacuum. Not afraid of water, but just not liking water. So it's like an insulation. So that the watery cells have a way of staying with themselves. It's that hydrophobic vacuum that allows for cells to come together, but not to make a blur. And just so, in exactly the same way, All paths are hermetically sealed. You are the only one on your path. But they can be brought together, and this is the form of the spiritual community, they can be brought together in terms of a jhana. And the most powerful jhana fall is the parijhana, because it's what really does happen. The Buddha's sermon in the Majjhima Nikaya, in the middle length sayings, ran like this. He always began in a rote formula so as to get everyone's attention in terms of their marga. He said, monks, I am sitting in this room. I am in this meditative posture with my robe bearing the left shoulder and my folds arranged and my mind composed. And I am in this room. And just as I am in this room, the room that I am in is within this house. Its robes are arranged and gathered. Its thusness is actually here in this house. And just in this way, this house is in this city. And this city, with its robes adjusted, its folds arranged, occurs actually. And just as this city and this house and this room and I am here, so too this city occurs in this continental landform. The Buddha used the term Jabudvaya, which was the ancient term for India. The man occurs within the room within the house within the village, the city within the continent, and the continent within this planet. And I, sitting here, measure these ripples very accurately, and the planet fits into the wide openness of the void in just that way. Now, in the Buddha's Majjhima Nikaya sermon, it's called the forest sermon. One gets the sense that your actuality can be sequenced in a contextual accumulation, but that does not go on forever. There is a point at which the context becomes infinite, opens out, becomes beyond dimension. And it takes about that same number of steps. 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, infinity. If you describe that sixfold sequencing in the right way, the next jump is beyond. If you become clever about it, the wholeness of that sixfoldness becomes a seven quality, beyond which is that openness. There are two different versions, there are two different dialects of method by which one can speak about this. In the pristine Asian tradition, it's always a six quality. In the Western tradition, it's always a seven quality. Beyond which, beyond that ultimate formedness, is the wide openness of the no boundary unformedness, or as John Scotus Erujina would say, the uncreate. And the uncreate is not a part of nature in a natural way, it's a part of nature in a supernatural way. And when a human being is able to understand that, he plays in nature in such a way that he is able to precipitate out. What is still natural in him is still here in nature, but what is supernatural within him is free. Not just free for a moment, and not free for this lifetime, but free. No conditions whatsoever. Though in our traditional psychological sense, that point of accumulation leading to freedom, to liberation, is the deep self. But the deep self, in its natural way, generates consciousness as a supernatural quality. Freedom is not just freedom and that's it, period, but it is a dynamic. It has a dynamic of its own. It has a differential dynamic which has a no boundary characteristic. So that consciousness is actually not a form in itself, but a flow. William James' great phrase, the stream of consciousness, is very accurate. But to think of it as a stream and put a mental picture of some stream that you once saw reduces it down. That's a reductionism that one has to be cautious of. There is no mental picture of it. It's difficult to do this, so usually in a traditional teaching, one would be given a symbol to visualize in your mind, a kind of a symbol that when you master the visualization of it, will dissipate itself into truth. So here's a symbol for you. The stream of consciousness is like a pure flow of crystal clear water that flows through a circular rainbow. And it's the spinning of that circular rainbow that allows for the amperage of the flowing crystal clear water to occur. That's a symbol of the deep self in its generation of consciousness. If you know scientifically that the rainbow in visible light shades into the invisible on both sides, then you have it. Then you have it. The whole electromagnetic spectrum arranged in a circular flow allows for the crystal clear motion of life to occur. That is a very powerful meditative and visualization symbol, and it's quite accurate. What is that a symbol of? That is a symbol of the deep self as it is, in its own right, without natural characteristics. In other words, there are temporary natural characteristics, rainbow, water, flow, circularity, and so forth. But the gestalt that I've given you is formed in such a way it's formed like a bow instead of a knot. So that the more you work with it, it doesn't get tighter, but it comes untied and lets you open the present of its actuality. Now we're going to take a break, but let's come back for just a moment. Let's bring our minds and our attention back from all of these words, back from all of these things. Let's come to this flag that Gandhi used. This is the spinning wheel, the charka. This is the instrument of liberation that Gandhi chose. economically, anyone could build one of these spinning wheels and could spin in a day, make enough yarn or thread to sell, to make enough to live on, to pay for your food and your lodging and just the basicness. So it was a key economically to independence for Indians out of the British Empire feudal situation. But when one used a spinning wheel, and he saw it in his mind first, and they had to search all over India, and finally somebody's aunt found an old archaic spinning wheel in an attic. When you spin with it, the wheel hums as it turns. And the hum is a white sound. And that white sound is the perfect backdrop against which self-realization can occur. And also it focuses the hands. One for the spinning spectrum, the other for drawing the thread out. It was a natural way of achieving enlightenment. Let's take a break.